Isn't it great when you have something to look forward to, like the latest episode of this podcast, or even better, an amazing Italian getaway? Well, Explore Worldwide's new Amalfi Coast Discovery Tour is a slice of heaven. I'll be telling you more about it later in the podcast, but for now, I'll leave you with this. Their big blue sale is now on, and you'll save up to 20% on Explore's most popular small group adventures. Click the link in the episode description or book at exploreworldwide.com.au and don't just travel, explore.
A Listener production.
I had built this veneer that separated me from the world. And in my early 30s, I started thinking, if I don't chip away at this, I'm never going to really connect to anybody. And then what would be the point of life?
Hi, I'm Jess Rowe, and this is the Jess Rowe Big Talk Show, a podcast that skips the small talk and goes big and deep. From love to loss and everything in between, I want to show you a different side of people who seem to have it all together in these raw and honest conversations about the things that matter. Melissa Leong describes herself as, quote, a self-confessed, hyper-independent, introvert, high-achieving personality with trauma issues and some fun mental health challenges thrown in. She's also a Gold Logie-nominated television presenter after being a judge on MasterChef Australia, as well as a food and travel journalist, food media consultant, radio broadcaster, and cookbook editor. Melissa is an extraordinary woman, and food is central to who she is. She has just written a breathtakingly honest and beautiful memoir titled Guts. Now, a gentle content warning before we get started. This conversation touches on eating disorders and sexual assault, so please listen with care. Melissa, I have been yearning to get you into this studio. I have you at last, and I have inhaled your memoir. It's delicious to read.
Thank you. I've been wanting to be here for ages. We've had this conversation about, oh, you know, it'd be an honour to be in this room with you. And I adore your conversations with, you know, all manner of your guests over the years. So it is a real privilege to be here. And thank you so much for saying such kind things about how you've consumed my book, because people are reading it, which is wild to me, because it sort of just comes out of your heart and your soul and you put it down in a Word document and suddenly it becomes a thing.
It's out there in the world. But even in the way you say consumed, I mean, that's a foodie word.
Yeah.
Food is at the heart of who you are. And perhaps for our listeners, you could indulge us by reading a part from your memoir that I thought summed up a lot of it, or you.
Sure, it would be my absolute pleasure. I have found love and meaning in this world through food. Food is history, evolution, culture, feeling. It is the balm that soothes me when I ache, the way stories are passed down, and a way to remember those who have long left us.
Beautiful. And it is at the heart of who you are. Could I begin by talking to you about what food meant to you growing up? It was very much an integral part of your childhood.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm Singaporean Chinese, so food is the first thing you think about when you wake up in the morning. It dominates, you know, thoughts throughout the day. What's your next meal going to be? And I like to say, you know, especially for a lot of Asian cultures, saying I love you and receiving a hug from a loved one or a relative, you know, or hopefully both, it's not something that happens as regularly as maybe I would see other families on television or other families of different cultures in my life when I was growing up. But the way that we say I love you, the way love is expressed, is through the cooking for and the eating with of food with our families. And so food was always that thing that even when there'd be some, you know, fight or you'd done something bad and your parents are a bit grumpy at you, all would be forgiven at the dinner table. And through the sharing of food, all the woes of the world were washed away. and we could start afresh again. And so I always looked forward to food because no matter how complex life can get, you know, when you're a kid, your problems are big problems. They dominate your whole world. You forget about those problems when you sit down and you know, you inhale a bowl of noodles or, you know, you eat rice. For me is a really important thing. It's a real sort of, you know, soul sustenance thing. And so being able to share food and to kind of take a minute away from the problems in your life, everything can be solved with a meal.
And your mum was a glorious cook, or
yes,
is a glorious cook, isn't she?
My mum's a fantastic cook, and I think I really inherited a love of food from her. And she would be the first person to say that she didn't start out that way. When she moved out of home, she was a nurse student and became a registered nurse and then moved on to being a hospital administrator. But through that process of being a young adult, moving to a different country and, you know, flatting with people and then eventually getting married, she had to teach herself how to cook. And coming from Singapore, which is this glorious place where you don't have to spend even a lot of money to eat extraordinarily well. And so you don't have to learn how to cook if you live there. But if you miss that food, I think that's, and that certainly happened for me, is when she started to miss the food is when she started to teach herself how to cook and recall the dishes her mother would cook, and you know, it becomes this beautiful generational thing that gets passed down. Yeah, so food was always this great thing, and my mother was definitely the gateway for both the enjoying of food, learning how to really savour food, but also to learn how to cook as well.
When you were growing up, when you sit at the dinner table, all the troubles could be left behind.
Yeah.
As a young girl, there were times that you did struggle where you wanted to fit in.
Yeah, absolutely. I grew up in the Sutherland Shire in the 80s. And so for people that don't know what the Sutherland Shire is, it's a beautiful, beachy, gorgeous sort of part of New South Wales. At the time in the 80s, it was a very homogenous community of you know, Anglo-Saxon Australians. And there was a lot of blonde hair and blue eyes and stubby shorts and things like that. And it was made very apparent very early that I did not look like everybody else. That part was very obvious. I was one of, I think, two Chinese families in my primary school. There's maybe one Greek, one Italian family as well. But it was mainly culture, not of my background. And all you want to do as a kid is fit in. Like, all you want to do is just be accepted by your peers and just to feel like you blend in and you're accepted. And, you know, there are times where that was the case. And then there were times where it became very obvious that I was different, my brother was different. And you know, that part makes you feel a little on the outer. And I think it was probably from that point in my life that I cultivated the beginnings of feeling a little like an outlier in my life and maybe sought a way to cope with that in terms of developing independence.
And also using it in getting your power. So rather than seeing it as a disadvantage, being an outsider, in a sense, has it emboldened you?
Absolutely.
To do wild and crazy things?
Absolutely. I think that over time it's become this real point of pride for me that being on the outer, being a little bit different, means you have to find your own way to where you want to go. If you're not part of the pack, you're more exposed, yes, but then you also don't have the hubris of everything around you to kind of push you in a direction that maybe you don't want to go. And so I think being an outlier or being an outsider allows you to develop that sort of independent thinking and just independence in general. And it helps you, I guess, find agency over where you want to go. So you become the captain of your ship a lot sooner, or at least you become more comfortable with the idea of going it alone.
And doing things in your way. In your beautiful memoir, Guts, you talk about being a weirdo. And I love that because I embrace being a weirdo. Mm. I love to be different.
How good is it?
It's the best. But it takes time. But you strike me as someone, you got there sooner. Would that be accurate?
I mean, yes and no. I think there's a part of everybody, you know, I have a chapter called In a Conventional Oven. There is still, even if you're a weirdo, you still feel that there are parts of convention that you want. We still need, as humans, to feel at home, accepted somehow, however you create that world for yourself. Would I have called myself a weirdo from early on and become comfortable with it early? I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, if I think back in my childhood, to my childhood, there was still definitely the yearning to just want to blend in. But I guess a gentle acceptance over time that if I am a little bit different, that that's okay. But you, like you said, it takes a long time. And I don't think it was until maybe in my 30s that I started to really settle into, okay, I'm good with who I am. I don't need to dress the same as everybody else. I don't need to like the same things all of the time. And if I do, that's because I really do, not because I feel the pressure to. And I think the older we get, the less fucks we give in general. And I think that's really good because then we don't need to feel beholden to trends and to what other people are doing. We just become more of ourselves. And for some people who aren't yet there, that can be terrifying, you know. And some people don't treat you well because you are holding a mirror up to the fact that they're not there yet as well. So it's a really interesting thing, which only sort of further pushes you into being your own beautiful weirdo. But I think at that point, you don't care anymore.
And it is freeing. That's what I love about getting older. But looking back at when you were younger, and there's a quote in the book where you describe yourself as a difficult child of Singaporean migrants who were hoping for a more compliant, grateful firstborn. So already there was those signs, I suppose, of rebellion or just not wanting to fit the mould.
Yes.
How hard was it, though, to grow up in your household?
Well, like you just said, you know, I think a lot of parents want a kid that's going to do what they're told because they, you know, you get less problems and headaches that way, I'm sure, as a parent. But I remember having a lot of questions when I was a kid. I wasn't kind of comfortable with just doing what I was told without understanding why I was doing them. And I'm sure that that was super annoying. But I needed to find and understand the reason for things, because what would be the point sometimes of doing, you know, going from A to B if that's not at all the direction you want to go in? So I think my parents found that a little frustrating. I felt it frustrating as a kid because you don't yet have the language or the self-possession to be able to articulate that internal, like that turmoil that you feel about wanting to be articulate, wanting to achieve clarity, because that all takes time. That's a lifetime of, you know, lessons and learning and growing in order to get there. And you have to earn that. But I just remember being a kid and just being like, I don't understand why, you know. And maybe it would have been less stressful for them if I ended up, you know, going through a more linear path of high school, you know, go and do a law degree, become a lawyer, you know, and be financially stable from an early age and all of that. But very early on, it was very apparent that I was not going to, I didn't want that. I didn't know why, but I knew that it didn't feel right to approach life that way. And so I have made a life and a career out of leaning into intuition, saying yes to things that slightly scare me, and maybe leaning into accepting failure as one of the greatest lessons you could possibly welcome into your life sometimes.
That is a big lesson. And I think it is important. I've learned to embrace failure.
Yeah.
Because that's where we really learn.
Yeah, if you win all of the time.
If it's easy.
If everything is easy to you, you're nowhere near as grateful or as empathetic, I think. And I think it doesn't make you a full 3D human being if you don't have failure in your life, because failure is, you know, the greatest teacher of so many things that we need to be human.
You've had a sense of things not being quite right from an early age, which I think is quite remarkable for a young person to be able to tap into that.
Yeah.
At the age of 9, you were, you know, growing up in suburbia, and you had a sense of looking out thinking, there's got to be more.
Yeah.
And that's happened a number of times in your life where you've been brave enough to basically blow things up.
Yep. Yeah.
And walk away from things that on the outside look
perfectly fine.
Yes.
Yeah, perfectly fine.
Where does that bravery or fearlessness come from, do you think?
Well, I don't think, like, anyone who's ever done anything brave doesn't do the thing going, oh, I'm being very brave. You just do it, right? It's a compulsion that's deep within you that you need to do something, you know, whatever that happens to be. And for me, even though I haven't fully understood why I feel that way, there's always just been this, like, in the chest, deep in the chest, a feeling of like a magnetic pull that this is not where I need to be. And it's almost like the polar opposite, you know, effect when you have magnets and they polarize each other. It pushing me away from the life that I don't want, even if it's perfect on paper. And a number of times, especially in my sort of 20s, I've had this sort of seemingly ideal existence. And to the point where people would say, well, why would you want to walk away from that? And there's no easy answer other than to say, it doesn't feel right. And if I keep doing this, I know I'm not unhappy now, but I know I will be at some point, and that I would be doing everybody in this equation a disservice if I stuck with it. And blowing up your life sounds really sexy, and it sounds like a fantastic thing to do. You like push the red button.
Sparkly. Fireworks.
Do it. It's going to be amazing. And then you get the movie montage and it's all really fantastic and you're wearing great shoes and it's a great scene. But the reality is that it can be really destructive to other people in your life. It can be really disappointing. I know I definitely broke one heart for real. And you know, so I did it with a huge amount of consideration for, I knew what I was doing. I didn't do it flippantly. And so when people say, oh, you know, I wish I could do that, or I'm going to like throw it all in, I invite people who are thinking that to really give it a lot of serious consideration, because it isn't just about how it changes your life. It's about how it changes everybody else's life as well. And I remember at the time that particular partner, he was such a sweet guy and he was my best friend. And it was just before I moved to Tasmania. And I remember how hurt he was. And I said, when you are with the love of your life, with the children that you want in your home, many years from now, you'll understand why I did this, but I know you're really hurt right now. And I know how hurt he was at the time, but all I can say was that I did think about the life he wanted and the life he could have and does have happily, you know. And sometimes you don't get that amount of clarity. But thinking of others has been a big theme in my life, sometimes to my own detriment. But in that particular case, even though I didn't know how it was all going to shake out, I knew that I was doing ultimately a service to everybody by, you know, picking up the tracks and moving them so the train could head in a different direction in my life.
And also doing a service to yourself first and foremost. And that can be hard. I think especially for women, it can be difficult to put ourselves first because we want to make everyone else okay.
We're conditioned to take care of everybody in our lives before we take care of ourselves. And they all, you know, like that, the safety demonstration when you get on the plane or a boat or something, right? Strap on your own oxygen mask first, put your own life vest on first. We know these things to be true. You cannot save other people. You cannot protect and nurture other people if you are not whole yourself. You're not protected first. But there is an instinct in us to eschew our own well-being and our own, you know, selves in deference to other people sometimes. And I think we need to reframe this idea of you're being a selfish woman, because we all know that whole women take care of whole communities. And so we should not feel apologetic about making sure that we put the things in place to make sure we're okay. I couldn't say half the things that I've said if I hadn't lived the life I've lived, if I hadn't pushed the big red button and been selfish. So in a way, I'm very grateful for learning that it is okay to take care of myself.
And during this particular time, you were living in Tasmania.
Mm.
And it was such a different life.
Yeah.
And there were bits that I was discovering about you, like skinning a rabbit.
Yeah, lived on an abattoir, lived on a sheep dairy. Yeah, it was a great life. Like, it wasn't planned. I had gone to Tasmania on a holiday and then I'd come back and I'd felt that big, you know, that ennui, that...
What a beautiful word.
Isn't it a great word? You know, like
and you
that,
say it beautifully.
The only, like that existential dread that you have. I felt that sort of dread and I said, okay, I'll email some friends and I said, can I come and stay on your farm? And there's a program called Woofing, like Willing Workers on Organic Farms. And so if you are traveling from overseas, you can extend your visa by going to work on smallholder farms. And so you volunteer work, they extend your visa. And so I said, could I just come and do some of that volunteer work in exchange for just staying on the farm? And my friend said, look, you're a friend, so no, but you can come stay with us and you can you can come and help and we can teach you some things. And so, especially being on the sheep dairy at Grandview Cheeses, I got to, you know, do everything from help with the sheep shearing to milking sheep to stirring the curds to affinage, you know, making sure that the cheeses
are all... affinage?
It's the aging of cheeses. So it's where, you know, especially with when you're treating cheeses with blue mold, for example, that they need to be aerated and turned on a very regular basis so that everything happens in a healthy way, because you're dealing with bacteria essentially. But that needs to be done in a very conditioned way in order to get this beautiful product. And when you see how much care goes into getting the milk from the sheep and all of that effort, the last thing you want is to waste any of it. So everything needs to be done with care and respect. So I got to be part of lots of different processes in the, you know, in the dairy side of things and the cheese making side of things. I lived on an abattoir for a big chunk of that time as well. And it was all sort of a bit of an organic experience, having conversations with people and then, you know, ending up in the places that I've ended up. And it was the greatest education in food I could possibly have asked for, because, you know, we spend a lot of time in the sexy big city, you know, eating at beautiful restaurants and drinking, you know, a wine out of, you know, beautiful crystal glasses and all of the rest of it. But if you have no connection with where your food comes from, you're really missing a trick. And I think for me, being given the opportunity to educate myself from literally the ground up has given me an edge and a sense of respect about this industry that I get to talk about. And I remember moments in that Tasmanian life where I thought, what the fuck have I done? What have I done? I don't really have a home. Like, I'm staying with friends. I'm, you know, don't have a home. I don't know what I'm doing. You know, I've got enough work to tick along to be okay, but this is not really, you know, a career. This is not the dream career with the, you know, the big wide world that I was hoping for. What's going to happen now? And it's so nice that 12 years later, I can look back, you know, at this physical book now and all of the things that have happened in this last decade or so and go, I made the right choice. And that is the power of intuition.
And trusting that. Because often we can try and be logical and sort of logic our ways out of things.
Yeah.
And look at this extraordinary, beautiful, big life that you have created.
Yeah.
But life is never perfect, as we know. And sometimes we don't listen. And you also share in your book how you felt you should be married by a certain time. Mm. So you decided to get married.
Like, that's logical, isn't it? Isn't it so crazy? It's this, the 35-year itch, I'm going to call it, 35-year itch. And I've had this conversation with girlfriends who have who are either approaching it now or have just passed through it, or 35 is long in the rear vision mirror. And there's something about converging on this like stupid arbitrary birthday, 35. I should have X boxed off, buying a house, being married, whatever. For me, it was marriage. And one of my best friends recently, last year, it was home ownership. She's like, why don't I own a home? I'm like, because if you pressure yourself to buy a home now, it could be the wrong one. There might be something wrong with it. You could find yourself in crippling debt. Like, making choices because you forced yourself to make choices rarely ends well. It's rarely ideal. And for me, yeah, I was like 34. God, I should be married by now. Oh, you'll do. Like, it was, I mean, without being callous, it was kind of like that. It was the guy I was dating at the time, and it didn't end well. Like, you know, well, it ended. So that's all you really need to know. But I take ownership over that choice. And, you know, people would buy this memoir going, oh, I want all of the tea. And it's like, there's tea, like there's plenty of tea and it's piping hot, but it's written in a way that this is my memoir. And I'm conscious that when you walk through life, so many lives are affected by your life, because if we're lucky, we have all of these beautiful human connections around. But this is my story and my narrative. And so I don't think it's fair to kind of nitpick at who did what to me and how. But what I can speak to with all of my heart and soul is how the choices I made and how I navigated the situations I found myself in. And that was one of them, was that, you know, the chapter on marriage and divorce really isn't about the relationship itself. It's about me putting myself through a set of circumstances I really shouldn't have. And could I be surprised that it didn't affect me well?
Because it was a very dark time and you developed bulimia during that time.
Yeah, I did. And God, I had such a mentee be about writing about that because I thought, oh, look, you know, can you imagine when sometimes tabloids are very kind and sometimes they're not very kind. And the irony of the food girl having an eating disorder is, you know, it's not lost on me. That makes a nice, you know, splashy headline. But it is my truth. And for me, at least, my eating disorder was about a complete lack of control in my life. And this was the only thing that I could control. You know, like if you talk to people with eating disorders, we're all obsessed with food. That's all you can think about. It's not that you hate food and you don't want it in your body. You do. You want it so much. But it's about control. And it certainly was for me that there was no control in my life. And I found myself in a place that I felt I couldn't get out of. And that was the only way I could construct something that I felt I had autonomy over. And I was absolutely miserable. So it's what happened. But hey, the day I signed my divorce papers, I haven't done it since. So
isn't that telling?
Indeed. Yeah. And so I think living in harmony with who we are, you know, for me, and what I want people to come out of reading this, if they do choose to read it, and thank you so much for doing that if you do, is that we need to make choices we can live with. We need to make the choices that make us feel in keeping in harmony with ourselves, our world. And then, you know, I think that we find the balance such as it is.
Remember, your next international getaway dream can come true with Explore Worldwide's Big Blue Sail. Their small group adventures allow you to really connect with the culture, not just tick off the sights. Explore Worldwide's expert tour leaders get you closer to the colour of Morocco, the peaceful beauty of Japan, or the hidden gems under the glorious Italian sunshine. And with their Big Blue Sail on now, you'll save up to 20% on Explore's most popular small group adventures. Click the link in the episode description or book at exploreworldwide.com.au and don't just travel. Explore.
You lay yourself bare very much in this memoir, Guts.
Yeah.
And there's a particular section where you talk about a lunch at Marie Claire. And I was at that lunch. And it was an incredibly moving event. But for you, it was even more so a time that made you think about a time in your life.
Yeah, absolutely. Gosh, what a privilege to be in those rooms. Younger me would never have believed I would earn a spot at the table at a lunch like that with the most impressive women in the country, you know, and yourself included. It still blows my mind because in that room, you know, are the most accomplished people. You have Grace Tame in there, you know, you've got Tanya Plibersek and Anna Coutts-Trotter who were there as well. And I was there to speak about my experiences, you know, a woman of colour in media, and it was a perfectly fine chat. It was just light and fluffy, and I thought, oh, this is easy, but what a joy to get to be in this room because of it. That's so cool. I was, like, feeling great. I was like, oh, like, I'm really coming into earning a place in this world with these really accomplished women. What an honour. And so I had fun, you know, kept it light and chatty and all of the rest of it, and then, you know, another course gets served, and Tanya and Anna spoke, and theirs was, you know, a much more serious conversation because that's what Marie Claire do really well, I believe, is not shying away from the difficult discussions that we need to have as women and just as people in general. And, you know, they shared Anna's story of coercive control and abuse in her teens and how that affected her life and how Tanya felt so powerless at many points to do anything to help her. And they were so raw and honest about how this horrible situation had impacted their lives. But the way that Anna speaks about her experience with such honesty broke a dam wall in me about something that I had been repressing for such a long time. Because, of course, I've sat in these rooms before and I've heard horrible stories about things that have happened to friends of mine and to survivors who I greatly admire. And I've always thought, gosh, that's a horrible thing to have happened. I want to be there as a support. I want to be there as an ally. And I didn't identify myself as having gone through any experience that would make me identify as a survivor. And when Anna described, and she described it in really beautiful detail, which is a horrible way to describe a horrible situation, but the way she described things so personally were things that I had felt in my life. And it just, you know, it came flowing forward. And all of a sudden I'm sitting in a room full of, you know, incredibly accomplished women, and I just, the tears began. And I'm aware that this is not the moment to crack. And Curly Saunders was sitting at the table behind me, and she couldn't even see me. And she just grabbed my hand and held onto my hand behind the table. And we listened to Tanya and Anna speak. And I went, and then I excused myself as soon as they were done. And I just went and sat in the, you know, in a bathroom cubicle and just cried. And I had to face the fact that I had repressed my own experience of assault so badly that it was shocking to me to be confronted by these feelings. And so I was never planning on writing about it in the book, about being raped. And in my era of being much more, you know, closely enmeshed in hospitality. But clearly it wanted to be told, and it needed to come out of me. And I realized in that moment that this is not my shame. It's not my shame. I didn't ask for it. It's not my fault. I need to stop feeling bad about what I may or may not have done to be part of that environment and that particular situation that led to me being raped. And I am angry still, you know, I'm still processing a lot of it. I'm angry that we don't speak up about these things. And I'm mad at myself that I didn't understand issues of consent the way we understand them now. And it's because of people like Anna and Grace and, you know, Chanel and so many other women who have gone through these experiences that we need to embolden ourselves to take these conversations out of the dark into the light and shift the shame, because it's not for us to hold on to. And it's complex because I don't want to name the person who did this to me, because then it becomes a whole other conversation, and I don't want to have it, and I don't want my name connected to his name publicly, and so I don't want to do that. But what I do want to do in sharing this in my book is to help people understand, or at least contribute to this conversation about consent and understanding it better. Because had I have understood consent better then, I would have probably spoken up. Instead, I thought, oh, I don't want to be tarred and feathered as a silly little girl who works in PR. And I felt that it was my fault.
Thank you for sharing in the way you have, because it is not your shame. It helps so many of us. And you are a beautiful, brave, delicious voice. And you bring so much beauty and compassion and understanding. And you do give people a safe place. So thank you for doing that.
Yeah. It's, I'm trying to see this time talking about the book as part of the process of letting it go. And it's out there now. It's part of the conversation. And I hope that it is a constructive part of the conversation about, I don't want people to get caught up in the detail of specifically what happened to me so much as I want people to understand that we can find ourselves in situations like this anytime. And if we should find ourselves there, that we know how to walk out of that situation, not holding on to shame that isn't ours, not holding on to any kind of feeling of blame that you were a part of something. I wasn't a part of something. Something happened to me and it's not fucking okay. And it is very unfortunate that what happened to me happens to many people. And I think now, especially in hospitality, there's a bit of a reckoning happening. People are finally speaking up. And to name names, you know, there are women who have named names about lots of different things that have happened, and they are so incredibly brave because their lives are changed forever for making those choices. But those choices will benefit the industry as it moves forward.
And you're very open to about mental health.
Yeah.
Which I just applaud, having myself experienced and still deal with anxiety and depression.
I think both of those, anxiety and depression, allow us to be acutely aware of what's going on, sometimes too much, but it does make us very present people when things are in balance.
It's so true. Yeah. And I've learned so much, not only about myself, but other people.
Yeah.
And everyone is going through something.
Yeah.
And for you, what have you found useful? Because I think, you know, people always are looking for practical tips and ways to manage through these sorts of things. What have you found has helped your mental health?
And it is very unique to everybody. You know, the way people cope is very, proprietary to them, I think. But there are some common threads and things that that tend to be helpful for lots of people. And for me, you know, I oscillate between anxiety and depression a bit. You know, things have been all right on the depression front for a while, but anxiety, especially around promoting the book, because of course it isn't just one thing to write a book, then you have to talk about it and put it out there, because that's the other vital part of the life cycle of it. And I've really had to put my money where my mouth is in terms of implementing the things that are good for me. And it's, for me, being able to say no. And it's really hard in our jobs. You know, like, we are so lucky to get to do the things that we do, but when it rains, it pours, and it can be really hard to say no to a really great opportunity to interview somebody or to take on a gig or whatever it is. But learning to say no is the only sustainable way that we can do this. Like, at some point you have to stop. You know, yesterday I sort of got the schedule through and there were still interviews being kind of plugged into little gaps into my schedule. And I just had to send an email to my manager and say, would it be okay if we could just stop there? I think that's probably going to be enough for me for the day, because every time I have a conversation, I want to be fully present. I want to be completely open. And that requires giving a lot of energy, and I'm happy to do it. But there's a cap on that. And so knowing how much you have left in the tank and being able to say, thank you so much for this opportunity, but no, please ask me again another time. I would love to. That language is something that I'm still working on, but I'm getting better at it, is just putting a cap on limitations. So that's one thing. Therapy, love therapy. That's amazing for me. I mean, I'm very aware that it's a privilege to have a therapist. We don't always have the time and the resources in our lives to be able to do that, but I am very grateful for having somebody in my life I can go to and is just dedicated to helping me figure out the tools I need to make this all work. So being able to talk it out is a super important thing. And to add on to that, having very close friends that have you for the good times and the complex times, that you can be completely frank with and say, I'm just having a shit day. And I know that that's going to sound really ungrateful to somebody else, but to the people who know you, they know that that's just part of the context of what's going on for you, and that it's not being self-indulgent to complain about it. You just need to kind of
share it. You need to be able to tell the people that you love and know that you can be fully, wholly you without pretense, without the mask, without being, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
One thing you almost said no to was MasterChef.
Yes, that's true. I nearly said no. I'm sure that the big wigs over at Endemol were just like, she was never saying no. And maybe that's true, but I wanted to walk into that meeting. I knew what was going to be put on the table. I knew it. But I was working in journalism at the time, and a big part of that job is to be objective. You know, it's to be cynical, it's to question things that seem too good, because nothing is ever as good as it seems. And having observed the former three judges who did just the most remarkable job, and it was like they call it lightning in a bottle, and it really was, to see them go from being affable, lovely chaps doing a show that's really fun to just skyrocketing into the next stratosphere, I was aware that if I said yes to that job, that if I was lucky at least, the best case scenario would be that my life could change that much. And as a journalist, you can't write the same way because, you know, then everybody wants to know what you think. And so there would be some irrevocable changes in my life. And I had to really ask myself, was I ready for that? Did I want that? Or did I want to protect my relative anonymity and continue on doing my work in that way? So yeah, it was a conversation I walked away from saying, thank you, I'll have a think about it. And I genuinely did need to really stop and think about, okay, can I do the job? Yes, that's a given. But can I take on the other things that this job might mean? There's no pre-test you can do for that to see whether or not you have the capability. You kind of have to walk through the door and experience it for yourself. And I'm sure that you could share much wisdom on the choices you've made that have led you to all of the extraordinary things that you've done in your life, you've experienced in your life, but also the less than palatable parts of what this life means. It's hard to explain to people that haven't walked through the door, and I don't want to sound unrelatable in that way, but there are just some choices you make in life that no one can prime you for them.
Yes, yeah, sometimes you just have to walk through that door.
Yeah.
And say, well, let's see. Nothing can prepare you for it, but it's sometimes those things where if you didn't say yes,
yeah,
you'd regret it.
Yeah.
And you don't want to have a life, I think, with, oh, what if?
Yeah, what if I had done that? What if I'd taken that job? How would my life be different? And I recently, well, last year, I was offered in a sit-down interview with a very high-profile MMA athlete. And it was for UFC. It was about an upcoming fight. And
can we just stop there? I just think this is wonderful for listeners who aren't aware.
People are like, huh?
Yes, you love doing jiu-jitsu.
Yes.
And tell me, so what the UF, it's the United...
Ultimate Fighting Championship.
Yeah, and well, you'd commentate, don't
it's
you?
It's one of the biggest mixed martial arts
Sorry,
championships.
I just think it's amazing.
I should correct myself and say it is the biggest mixed martial arts championship league in the world. You know, it's a just over 30-year-old, you know, enterprise. And what it's done in terms of the growth of mixed martial arts as a sport and also just as a business is phenomenal, you know, absolutely phenomenal. But I started watching MMA during the pandemic. Some people baked. I got into perfume and MMA, go figure. But for me, it always comes back down to the question in life, what does it take to be truly fearless? What does it take? And so in this sport, you have two people in a cage effectively fighting each other with their own combination of skills. And it's skill, it's strategy, it's about being able to read the other person, it's about being able to study the other person and anticipate how they're going to try and get at you and win. It's human chess. Like it's like six games of chess happening all at the one time. And so for people that don't watch the sport, I get that it could be a lot. It's quite intense. But what I'm looking at is technique, strategy, the ability to, like what we call fight IQ, the ability to be really present and modify how you are, your action reaction in the cage itself. But also I'm so obsessed with that question, what does it take to be truly fearless? And so a big joy of getting to have these conversations with athletes is, what is your passion and your purpose? You know, what are the stories behind how you got to be here? And there are some tremendously heartbreaking stories of where some athletes have started to where they are now and how they've changed their family outcome, their community's outcome. There are some just beautiful stories there. So this was a very high profile interview, and I had a moment of imposter syndrome where I was like, maybe I shouldn't do it. Like, can I do this? And I called my friend Nick Cody, and he said, we go to watch the fights together all of the time. And he's my bud. And he said, you will regret saying no. Like, you will regret saying no. You might not regret, you know, saying yes, but you will regret saying no. And I just thought, well, that does it. Even if I fuck up, I will regret if I say no, because that opportunity won't come again. But saying yes means you can grow. And if you, like, the first time you do anything, you're never going to be great at it. It takes a while, but don't let that stop you from climbing that mountain if you want to climb it.
And to be fearless, which I suppose leads me to that question, of course, you talk about wanting to discover people's purpose.
Yeah.
What's your purpose? What would you say is yours?
I think I'm still figuring that out. But for me, I think one of the most valuable lessons I gleaned from the whole years of MasterChef thing is that I take great pride in creating an atmosphere or a framework for people to feel safe in order for them to feel comfortable enough to share their stories. So whatever that looks like, you know, however that forms itself, that's been the unifying quality. That's been the thread that's woven its way through most of my career. And so it comes down to understanding vulnerability as it pertains to human connection. You know, because if you can't be vulnerable, how can you expect people to share and open up with you if you can't lay yourself bare as well? And that was, you know, generally, you know, the biggest learning to come out of being in Tasmania as well, is that I had built up this beautiful shiny veneer of being in Sydney and being a professional in Sydney and social pages and nice clothes and all of that. And all of that's beautiful. Like, that's really nice. But I had built this veneer that separated me from the world. And in my early 30s, I started thinking, if I don't chip away at this, I'm never going to really connect to anybody. And then what would be the point of life? And so I met a friend in Tasmania who said, I believe I'm in your life to help you sand back the facade. And he was probably right, you know, because if I hadn't have done that, then I wouldn't have realized just how important this vulnerability piece is. And in learning how to own my softness and not be hard and shiny all of the time, everything has blossomed forth from embracing that. And so I want to continue to walk down that path and see where that leads me.
You're an amazing woman, Melissa, and it's been such a privilege to talk with you, to learn from you, to read your words, and you're just glorious.
Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, it was such an honour to listen to Melissa share in that way. And that message of hers, that shame is not hers to carry. It was a real privilege to have that conversation with her. And of course, if this has brought up anything for you, please reach out. You know that Lifeline is there. Their number is 13 11 14. As well, there is the Respect line, which is 1-800-RESPECT. And we will have both of those in our show notes for you. Melissa's beautiful memoir, Guts, is out now. I adored it. It is delicious to read. Melissa has such a way with words. You can hear how articulate she is. And when she gets words on the page, it is such a joy to read. As well, there are recipes at the end of each chapter. You know I'm a crap housewife, but there is one or two recipes that I want to try. So grab Melissa's beautiful memoir. It is called Guts. And if you love this conversation with Melissa, there are so many more incredible conversations waiting for you here on the Jessro Big Talk Show. Hit subscribe. It is free and it means you'll never ever miss a dose of Big Talk when a new episode lands. And if you know someone who would really connect with this episode, someone who is passionate about food, someone who might be at a crossroads in their life, someone who is thinking about trusting that instinct, wanting to lead a more fearless life, this is the conversation for them. All you need to do is to tap the three little dots and share it with them. It is the easiest way to spread the big talk love and to help our podcast community grow. And if this conversation left you thinking or feeling something big, I reckon you'll also love my chat with Julie Goodwin. You'll find a link waiting for you in the show notes.
I will always carry terrible guilt and shame about that thing. Trying to work on the shame because, you know, that's the I am bad as opposed to I did something bad. I'll never lose the I did something bad because I did. But what that did was I just realised in that moment how far away from who I am I had gone.
The Jess Rowe Big Talk Show is hosted by me, Jess Rowe. Executive producer, Nick McClure. She's a wonderful leopard lady. Audio imager, Nat Marshall. Until next time, remember to live big. Life is just too crazy and glorious to waste time on the stuff that doesn't matter. Okay, now it is time to explore, because now it's time to tell you a little bit more about Explore Worldwide's new Amalfi Coast Discovery Tour. Imagine lemon groves, little cliffside villages, staying in a family-run hotel where the pasta is definitely better than anything you've made at home. Even better, it can all be yours for less, with up to 20% off in Explore Worldwide's Big Blue Sale on now. Click the link in the episode description or book at exploreworldwide.com.au and don't just travel, explore.